Hello, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm David Rogowski, and today I will be reading from Outside Magazine. Okay, last week we were talking about an article about tree DNA in the Olympic National Forest, where they're attempting to use tree DNA to find out who had poached a maple in the National Forest up there. So we'll continue right where we left off. Early in October 2018, Jackus escorted Cron and three members of his team into the forest to collect maple leaves. Like a human's, a tree's entire genome resides in all of its cells, from root to leaf. From 230 trees near Maple Fire's origin up the Hamahama River and adjacent drainages, Jackus and Huff had already collected samples from one stack of the blocks Wilk had sold to Tumwater Mill, along with the stumps of the two felled maples near the origin site. Using leaves he collected, Cron identified 117 genetic markers, known as signposts, on the big leaf genome, where high variability creates a sort of fingerprint for individual trees. Human forensics used only 20 such markers. Once established, a fingerprint from the felled maples could be checked against samples from the wood Wilk sold. The test proved more powerful than it needed to be. If there were a trillion big leaf maples on planet Earth, and there aren't, Cron explained, if there were a trillion identical Earths, which I don't think there are, the chance of finding a perfect match between any two trees is still less than 1 in a trillion. Cron set up in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Forensic Lab in Ashland, where Jackus had sent his bag samples. There they ground the wood to sawdust with a Dremel tool, extracted its DNA in a detergent wash, and sent the captured material to a genomic contractor called Neogen for analysis. They repeated the process in the fall of 2019 with the rest of the Tumwater blocks and a third felled maple, which Chapman had later informed Jackus. All told, 83 blocks of the 217 they evaluated for the mill came back with an exact match for the three poached trees. At Wilk's trial in July 2021, the jury found him guilty of 6 counts ranging from conspiracy to theft of government property and trafficking in unlawfully harvested timber. He was sentenced to 20 months in prison, the longest sentence for a tree thief at the time. Still, the jury wasn't convinced, as Jackus had been, that Wilk struck the match that started the maple fire. Testimony concerning that night birth of spark didn't always square. Thor had taken a plea deal a year earlier for his role in the fire. Though Chapman was never indicted, both took the stand against Wilk with divergent tales. Cron Science, though, told a clear enough story. It clinched the essential case against Wilk that Jackus' dogged investigation made. When the DNA of evidence matches the hunch and hard work from law enforcement officers, that is really gratifying, Cron said. But he knew the big leaf maple was just the beginning of the tale he began to reveal. Uncounted tree thefts were plaguing other forests across the country, and Cron hoped to cut short the chapter still being carved in public timber. In October 2019, witnesses tipped off a law enforcement officer to an illegal timber harvest near Siloam Springs in Missouri's Mark Twain National Forest. Forest Service Special Agent named Scott, who requested that only his first name be used, found 8 freshly cut black walnut stumps and began sleuthing at a nearby hardwood sawmill. U.S. Attorney's Office had never expressed much interest in pursuing timber cases which involved trees of low monetary value, but when Wilk was convicted in the Maple Fire trial, timber theft was suddenly getting press. Scott had found a log at the mill that jigsawed perfectly with a stump at the poaching site. The prosecutor attorney asked me a simple question: was there any way we could do a DNA match on this stump and the piece of wood from the sawmill? Cron, it turned out, was already in the midst of establishing a genetic database for black walnut, which fueled a lucrative illicit trade that spanned 32 states across the eastern U.S. Black walnut is really black gold, Cron told me. My gut-level impression is that eastern black walnut theft is where the real action is in terms of frequency and value lost. Working in tandem with citizen science organization, Adventure Scientists, and Mark Twain's staff, Cron found an identical match between the walnut stump and Scott's log. Todd Patterson, the man who sold it, pleaded guilty to depredation of government property and was sentenced last April to 5 months of time served. Cron and Adventure Scientists have since added range-wide genetic databases for Western Red Cedar, Alaskan Yellow Cedar, Douglas Fir, White Oak, and poached for stave bolts to forge whiskey barrels. This technology is sitting on the shelf, waiting for law enforcement to use, Cron said. On short notice, he can analyze evidence samples for thefts of those species anywhere in their range. Further applications for the databases include breeding vulnerable tree species for resilience against our shifting climate, identifying threatened and endangered trees ahead of proposed logging projects, and solving other crimes. In 2022, geneticists at the Missouri Botanical Garden helped convict a man of killing his wife by extracting the DNA from juniper needles stuck in the man's muddy boots and matching them to trees at the burial site. Jackus expects that the Forest Service will increasingly use tree DNA where thieves steal high-value trees from public land. Scott finds it to be a sharp tool, but noted that it's not going to stop all timber theft. Since his black walnut case against Patterson, Scott has taken a step further in directing his team to estimate not just the market value of the felled walnut's timber, but their entire ecological worth to a complex web of forest life. When these trees are cut, Scott pointed out, they're high-graded. They're the biggest and best trees in the area, no longer producing walnuts or acorns. You lose their dominant genetic diversity. Using these greater ecological values, U.S. attorneys have begun to prosecute more timber theft cases. It's a great development, Cron says, calling the approach innovative, because any forest is worth more than its weight in lumber. Well, engine boss Ben Dean was fighting the Maple Fire in 2018. He told the Kitsap Sun that as far as resources benefit goes, this is doing well for the forest. He found beauty in the flames of ants across the landscape. In an age of megafires, this was a low-intensity burn. Bertha, the origin tree, still stands, but charred, but still alive. 6 years after the Maple Fire, one local hiker from Quilcene said Elk Lake Trail number 805 was growing back nicely. Bambi and his little forest friends are enjoying the new habitat created by the fire. Life from death in the face of flame and saw. In her book, Tree Thieves, Lindsay Burgon writes that she has begun to see the act of timber poaching as not simply a dramatic environmental crime, but something deeper, an act to reclaim one's place in a rapidly changing world, a deed of necessity. Wilk, like so many tree thieves, was caught in a cycle tough to escape, out of work, bedeviled by drugs and poverty, forgotten plank in a crooked social scaffolding, and yet Wilk made a choice difficult to justify. For him, cutting maples morphed into an addiction, even a right. What transpired up there is not what the government led everyone to believe, Wilk told me just before he went to prison. Though he never took the stand in his own defense, he now maintains that he wasn't even present when Bertha caught fire and admits to cutting only one tree, both dubious claims. I don't feel bad that I did the government wrong. I feel bad that I did the people wrong, Wilk said. I mean, the government can take down hundreds of acres up there, prime timber, and what do we get out of that? That's our land up there. We should be able to. He trailed off, suddenly careful of his words, but it was clear what Milk meant. Those were his trees to cut. As a scientist, Cron prefers to let the woods speak above the voices in his own heart. Still, he has always loved the trees. All citizens in the U.S. own those forests, he said. When someone takes it in their own hands to claim this shared resource, they are taking it from American people. They are taking it from all of us, and we should all be outraged by it. And next up we have, this is the most crowded national park in the country. You should still go. Great Smoky Mountains National Park might be overrun, but that's only because it's wildly awesome. Here's why a trip to Great Smoky National Park should still be on your bucket list. It's by Graham Averill. Great Smoky Mountains National Park had more than 12 million visitors in 2024, or about 34,000 guests every day. That makes 522,427 acre swath of mountains, streams, and historic farmland the most popular national park in the country by far. The next most visited national park is Zion, with 4.95 million visitors last year, followed by Grand Canyon at 4.92 million. Great Smoky National Park is consistently the top park for visitation, partly because of its location in southwestern North Carolina and southeastern Tennessee. It's within 800 miles of 60% of America's population, and also because it's beautiful. The forest is lush and green, blanketing the park's 6,000-foot peaks, obscuring streams, waterfalls, and outcroppings. There are meadows full of elk and rivers stacked with trout, steep slopes, and placid lakes. Great Smoky National Park encapsulates the best southern Appalachians have to offer. So yes, people show up. On my recent trip to Great Smoky National Park, I sat for a solid hour in bumper-to-bumper traffic on Foothills Parkway, a scenic two-lane road that cruises the western border of the park. It sucked. But once I got inside the park, I was able to ditch the crowds and hike to High Elevation Bald, where I had a view of some of the prettiest damn mountains in the United States. Given the massive crowds, it could be tempting just to avoid the park altogether, says Stephen Reinhold, a photographer and owner of Appalachian Adventure Company, which works in and around Great Smoky National Park. But you'd miss out on what is arguably the most beautiful and biodiversity landscape in the country. The park, he notes, spans from 1,000 to over 6,600 feet in elevation, supporting a variety of different microclimates and ecosystems that range from southern Appalachian hardwood to Canadian spruce fir forests within a few miles of each other. The cultural history is diverse too, he says, from the stories and traditions of the Cherokee people to the preserved farms and homesteads of its early European settlers. Keep in mind that if you do plan to visit this spring or summer, western North Carolina is still recovering from Hurricane Helene. While Great Smoky Mountains National Park was largely spared by the brunt of that storm, it's possible that some roads or trails could be closed for rehabilitation. Be sure to check the status of the park and active closures here, and they provide a link. Living nearby Asheville, North Carolina, I've had a lot of adventures inside Great Smoky National Park. Sure, I waited for parking spots, but I've also hunted for salamanders with my children, gotten lost off trail twice, pedaled my bike across the entire park, run into black bears, jumped off waterfalls, climbed historic lookout towers, and paddled pristine lakes. The park might be crowded, but that's only because it's awesome. Here are six reasons why I think Great Smoky Mountains National Park is still worth visiting. Number one, the foliage is incredible. Come fall, the hardwood trees that blanket almost every inch of Great Smoky National Park transform it into a riot of red, orange, yellow, and gold from mid-September to early November. The timing for peak foliage depends on the elevation. The higher the trees, the earlier they turn. To see the most color overall, shoot for mid-October. Cruise the Newfound Gap Road, a 31-mile highway that crosses the heart of the park, will deliver nonstop color to the windows of your car. It's such a pretty drive, you probably won't even mind the crowds. If you want color with less traffic, head to the eastern border of the park where the Blue Ridge Parkway ends and the Hintuga Ridge Road begins. The first portion of the road is paved and has overlooks similar to what you'll find on the parkway, with views of the valley below and ridges on the horizon. After 9 miles, the pavement turns into one-lane gravel Hintuga Round Bottom Road, which drops for 14 winding miles into the depths of the park. It's a slow, one-way trek that puts you in the thick of the golden forest of autumn, passing creeks and small falls before forming a partial loop and arriving in the town of Cherokee, a vibrant gateway community within the 56,600-acre Qualla boundary, the cultural hub of the Eastern Band of Cherokee. Number 2, explore car-free biking. I've ridden my bike across a park on Newfound Gap Road, which is beautiful but harrowing, as the car traffic on that highway is nonstop, and the drivers seem unaccustomed to sharing the road with cyclists. Fortunately, park management has acknowledged us two-wheelers by creating vehicle-free days inside the popular Cades Cove throughout the busy summer months. Every Wednesday from May 7th to September 24th, the 11-mile loop through Cades Cove is closed to cars so walkers and cyclists can have the valley to themselves. This makes an easy, family-friendly pedal that delivers pastoral views and opportunities to check out historic structures such as cabins, churches, and school buildings. Among the plentiful hiking opportunities, Abrams Fall Trail is a 5-mile out and back that follows a stream culminating at the 20-foot Abrams Falls. Number 3, you can see and hear the elk rut. Elk were extirpated from North Carolina back in the late 1700s, but the National Park Service reintroduced the species to Great Smoky National Park in 2001, bringing 25 into the park from Kentucky. Almost 25 years later, the elk population is thriving, with numbers reaching almost 250, according to the most recent study. And they are huge. The bull elk in the park weigh an average of 600 to 700 pounds and can stand 5 feet tall at the shoulder. When my children were about 7, my wife and I took them to see the elk before Christmas, and they were convinced the animals were reindeer. Fall is the best time to see herds as it is their mating season, known as the rut, when males bugle and spar for the attention of females. Cataloochee Valley in the southeastern corner of the park typically has the largest concentration of animals, and the big meadow off Cove Creek Road is a good spot to watch and listen for the calls. I've seen the animals throughout the Smokies from the pastoral Cades Cove on the western side to the high elevations of Balsam Mountain on the eastern edge. The elk are magnificent, but keep your distance and stay quiet so as not to disturb them. Number 4, the fireflies put on a spectacular show. Fireflies are a delight throughout summer in the southern Appalachians and beyond, but a species of synchronous fireflies found inside the park puts on a choreographed light show every June. The bioluminescent beetles flash in unison 5 to 8 times in a row, pause for several seconds, and then kick in again. The prime time to catch the show is usually early June. You'll have to register in the lottery, $1 fee, for a chance to see the splendor. It's not easy to get a ticket. 20,000 people entered the lottery for just 1,240 vehicle passes in 2024. But you can't win if you don't play. Or you can book a guided backpacking trip with Blue Ridge Hiking Company, which covers roughly 13 miles of moderate terrain in the Elkmont area of the park over 2 days, taking in waterfalls and wildflowers during the day and synchronous fireflies at night. That's $1,970 for 2 people. And the fireflies are just the beginning. The Smokies comprise the most biodiverse unit in the entire national park system, with over 19,000 species of bugs, plants, and animals. The flame tiger snail, which can be found inside the park, emits a bioluminescent orange mucus when it's feeling threatened. Meanwhile, the hellbender salamander can reach 29 inches long. And did you hear the elk? 5. Winter is a great time to visit. Well, I've met people at Newfound Gap who have driven up from Florida in January so their kids can see snow for the first time. By and large, visitation drops significantly in winter, and it's a great time to explore the park. The trees don't have leaves, which might sound like a bummer, but their absence reveals long-range views from trails that are usually socked in by the canopy. Moreover, in my opinion, the best reason to visit Great Smoky National Park in the winter is cross-country skiing. Some of the park's highest roads go unplowed during heavy snowstorms, turning them into cross-country playgrounds for the hardy. The 7-mile Klingemans Dome Road leads to the highest point in the park, formerly called Klingemans Dome, and newly renamed Kuohi in honor of the Cherokee people, who consider the lofty peak sacred. Kuohi, which collects the lion's share of powder, is unplowed all season. Check road closures before going. Highway 441, aka Newfound Gap Road, is often closed for plowing, preventing access to Kuohi during the early part of storms. When the Newfound Gap Road opens, you can ski on Klingemans Dome Road and into Kuohi. I also like to watch High on LeConte, the innkeeper's blog for the backcountry LeConte Lodge, which sits a mile high in elevation for storm forecasts and snow totals. 6. Yes, you can avoid the crowds, and here's how. According to the most recent visitor use study from the Park Service, Cades Cove is the most frequented spot in the park, with almost half of all people planning to spend time in that area. Kuohe in the center of the park and Sugarlands Visitor Center on the western edge of the park also get a lot of traffic, while half of all people also plan to hit the gateway towns of Gatlinburg and Pigeon Forge, according to the same study. What am I getting at? Great Smoky National Park might attract 12 million bodies, but most of them are going to the same places. They hit Gatlinburg, visit Cades Cove, and drive a piece of newfound Gap Road to see Kuohe. That makes it pretty easy to avoid the crowds if you know what you're doing. Spent entire days inside Great Smoky National Park, feeling like I had the place to myself. There's not even available parking at those popular spots like Cades Cove and Klingman's Dome in the summer and fall, says Steve Duncan, the president of Smoky Mountains Hiking Club, who also volunteers for the park inside Cades Cove. Instead, visit the North Carolina side of the park, or the Cosby and Big Creek areas on the north end of the park, all of which see far less traffic. I like hiking to Andrews Bald on the Forney Ridge Trail, a 3.6-mile out and back that starts on the popular Klingman's Dome Road, but quickly leaves the crowds behind. Most people tend to stick to the nature trails and scenic walk up Concrete Lookout Tower, known as Klingman's Dome Tower, at the top of the mountain. You'll pass through a high-elevation spruce fir forest before hitting the Bald, a grassy area with views deep into the park. Or you can do something hard. The majority of visitors stick to short trails close to trailheads. I recently hiked to the top of Mount Kammerer, a craggy, sub-5,000-foot peak in the northern corner of the park with an incredible view from a historic lookout tower. I had the entire mountaintop to myself. Why? Because getting there required a tough 6-mile climb, and it was totally worth it. The view was stellar, taken in Pigeon River Gorge below. The Kammerer Tower is unique in the southern Appalachians, as it was modeled after the live-in fire towers more common in the western USA. You can also check out Fontana Lake, a 10,000-acre reservoir on the southwestern edge of the park, which offers lonely coves for paddling. Look for rope swings, and harbors isolated trails. I like the 3.5-mile piece of the Appalachian Trail that starts next to the Fontana Dam and climbs steeply to Shuckstack Fire Tower, where you'll find a broad view of the lake, Smokies, and neighboring Nantahala National Forest. Looking to camp? Try the undervalued Balsam Mountain Campground, a 43-site facility sitting at 5,300 feet elevation between the towns of Cherokee and Maggie Valley that has availability long after the uber-popular Cataluchi Campground fills up. $30 per night. Make reservations up to 6 months in advance. I just checked and found sites for this upcoming weekend. And if you have your heart set on hitting Kuohe or Cades Cove, you can still do it without the crowds. Go midweek or time your visit for sunrise, says the area guide Steve Reinhold. Hit the park early and you'll be done with your adventures before most visitors ever reach the trailhead. So that was an article by Graham Averhill in Great Smokies and Mountains National Park. He's Outside Magazine's National Park columnist and been visiting the park since he was a kid, and writing this article reminded him how much he loves that landscape. And next up is a new study. Lactic acid doesn't actually cause that burning feeling. Here's what does. Lactic acid has long been vilified, but new research shows that it doesn't impair muscle function. In fact, it might actually be good for you. This is by Alex Hutchinson. Like all great villains, lactic acid has been misunderstood. We've been blaming it for the pain we suffered during intense exercise for more than 2 centuries. There's nothing worse, we say, than lactic burn that locks our failing muscles into immobility. More recent tellings of the story have tried to rehabilitate lactic acid's reputation, insisting that it's actually trying to fuel our muscles rather than shut them down, but that version doesn't capture the full complexity either. Into this confusion steps a new review in the European Journal of Applied Physiology from veteran physiologists Simeon Carnes and Michael Lindiger. It's a dense 35-page doorstop titled Lactic Acidosis, Implications for Human Exercise Performance. And the clearest conclusion we can draw from it is that the precise cause of muscle fatigue during intense exercise are still a topic of active research and vigorous debate among scientists. But the sudden popularity of baking soda as an acid buffering performance aid has renewed conversations about how exactly lactic acid works in the body and how we might counteract it. Here are some highlights from the latest research. The lactic acid backstory. The first scientist to draw the connection between exercise and lactic acid was Johannes Jakob Berzelius, the Swedish chemist who devised the modern system of chemical notation, H2O, and so on. Sometime around 1807, he noticed that the chopped-up muscles of dead deer contained lactic acid, a substance that had only recently been discovered in sour milk. Crucially, the muscles of stags that had been hunted to death contained higher levels of lactic acid, while deer from a slaughterhouse who had their limbs immobilized in a splint before their death had lower levels, suggesting that the acid was generated by physical exertion. A century later, physiologists at the University of Cambridge used electric stimulation to make frogs' legs twitch until they reached exhaustion and observed high lactic acid levels. The levels were even higher if they performed the experiment in a chamber without oxygen and lower if they provided extra oxygen. That finding helped establish the prevailing 20th century view: your muscles need oxygen to generate energy aerobically. If they can't get enough oxygen, they switch to generating energy anaerobically, which produces lactic acid as a toxic byproduct that eventually shuts your muscles down. There are two small problems and one big one with this picture. The first detail is that while lactic acid can be measured in the muscles of dead deer and frogs, it doesn't actually exist in living humans. In the chemical milieu of the body, what would be lactic acid is split into two components, lactate and hydrogen ions. That's not just being persnickety about terminology. Lactate and hydrogen ions behave differently than lactic acid would. In fact, they can have separate and sometimes even opposing effects. The second detail is that lactate and hydrogen ions aren't really produced because your muscles are running out of oxygen. The chemical reactions that use oxygen to turn food into fuel muscle fuel are efficient but slow, great for powering relatively easy and sustained exercise, but they can't provide enough energy fast enough to supply an all-out sprint. For that, you'll eventually need to rely on lactate-producing anaerobic reactions, even if you're huffing pure oxygen from a can. The big problem with the old view of lactic acid is the idea that it's a metabolic villain. Turns out that, far from being an inert byproduct, lactate can be recycled into fuel for your muscles. In fact, one of the key superpowers that well-trained athletes develop is this ability to reuse lactate more quickly. This rehabilitation of lactate's reputation has been going on for a couple of decades now, though it still has a long way to go. But athletes are still left with unanswered questions. If lactate isn't what causes muscle fatigue, what is? And what the new review reveals, the first thing that Cairns and Lindinger established is that, yes, levels of lactate and hydrogen ions increase during intense exercise. This is most obvious during intense exercise lasting between 1 and 20 minutes. Longer bouts of exercise are less intense, so they can be mostly fueled by non-lactate producing aerobic energy, and bouts of exertion shorter than 1 minute simply don't have time to produce much lactate. The evidence is now clear that lactate itself doesn't interfere in any significant way with muscle function, but lactate and hydrogen ions are produced simultaneously in exactly the same quantities during anaerobic exercise, which complicates the lactic acid is a good guy after all narrative. Lactate may be great, but it comes with equivalent helping of hydrogen ions, and that may be a problem. When you increase the concentration of hydrogen ions in solution, you're increasing its acidity. That's how the pH scale is defined. It's a measure of hydrogen ions concentration. During intense exercise, the pH in your fast-twitch muscle fibers, which seem to be particularly susceptible to hydrogen ion buildup, can drop from about 7 to 6. That change represents a tenfold increase in the concentration of hydrogen ions, a situation that can wreak havoc on muscle contraction. The idea that hydrogen ions are what causes muscle fatigue isn't entirely straightforward either, though. When you start hard exercise, the concentration of hydrogen ions actually decreases for about 15 seconds while you use up another source of fast-acting muscle energy called fossil creatine. And yet your muscles are already getting fatigued during the initial burst, losing some of their maximal force, while hydrogen ion levels are still lower than normal. There's also a disconnect when you stop exercising or take a break between hard intervals. Hydrogen ion and lactate levels keep climbing for a few minutes, which is why the highest lactate levels are generally recorded several minutes after hard exercise. But you don't get weaker after you stop exercising, you get stronger as you recover, despite the rising concentration of hydrogen ions. So hydrogen ions may play a role in muscle fatigue, but they can't be the whole story. Another possibility is that hydrogen ions may interact with other molecules to disrupt muscle contraction. The most prominent candidates are potassium and phosphate, both of which increase during exercise and are associated in some studies with muscle fatigue. What these and other candidates have in common is that there are tons of conflicting results. They have different effects on muscle fibers depending on the level of acidity, the muscle temperature, and the test protocol. This suggests, not surprisingly, that there isn't a single molecule that causes your muscles to lose their power. Instead, it's the whole cocktail of things going on inside your muscles during hard exercise that matters. What about the burn? Most of the research that Cairns and Lindinger describes deals with muscle properties. How quickly are your fibers losing their twitch force and why? It's true that, as a middle distance runner, I've sometimes staggered down the finishing straight of a race with the sense that my legs are literally ceasing to function. It's an awful feeling to experience, but satisfying to look back on. You know, you left nothing out there. Far more common, though, is often a softer limit. You feel a red-hot burn and spreading numbness in your legs, and you choose to back off a bit. This feeling that we used to describe as going lactic is significant in its own right. Interviews with athletes who've begun using baking soda, a common theme is that they're able to push harder for longer before feeling that burn in their legs, which in turn enables them to race faster. One theory about feeling of going lactic is that you're literally starving your brain of oxygen. If you push hard enough, it's not just your muscles that go more acidic, your whole bloodstream follows, thanks to a phenomenon called the Bohr effect. Rising acidity reduces the ability of red blood cells to ferry oxygen from your lungs to the rest of your body, including your brain. In one study, all-out rowing caused oxygen saturation to drop from 97.5 to 89%, which is a big drop. Big enough, perhaps, to slow you down and contribute to the out-of-body feeling at the end of a hard race. We also have nerve sensors that keep the brain informed about the metabolic status of the muscles. These group 3 and 4 efferents, as they're known, keep tabs on the real-time levels of molecules like lactate and hydrogen ions. If you block these nerves with spinal injections of fentanyl, exercise feels great. Too great, in fact, because you lose all sense of pacing. Go out too hard, then hit the wall. The most telling finding about the lactate burn, in my view, was a 2013 study where they injected various molecules into thumbs of volunteers in an attempt to reproduce that familiar feeling. Injecting lactate didn't do it. Neither did injecting hydrogen ions, or ATP, a fuel molecule whose levels are also elevated during hard exercise. Injecting them pairs didn't do it either, but injecting all three at the levels you'd experience during moderate exercise produced a sensation of fatigue in their thumbs, even though they weren't moving them, and injection higher levels turned fatigue into pain. That's a distinction I try to keep in mind in the late stages of hard workouts and at the crux of races. That burning feeling is real, and it's associated with lactate and acidity and muscular fuel levels, but it's just a feeling. The lactate and ATP are actually helping me. The hydrogen ions, in combination with various other metabolites accumulating in my muscles, not so much. They'll eventually stop me, but until they do, I can keep pushing. So that was the Sweat Science article on lactic acid burn or not. You have been listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I've been reading from Outside Magazine. My name is Dave Rogowski. Thank you for listening.